The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Well, I'm delighted to be joined now for a bit of a chinwag from someone I regarded for more than three decades. Jim Power is one of the top economists. He used to work for banks and financial institutions, but he now tells it as he is. He's a gun for hire in terms of economic analysis to do with the sectors. He really understands under the bonnet of many aspects of the Irish economy. Welcome, Jim. So what I want to do is to basically set the scene for 2023. And my sense of this is that we've had this huge tailwind. Record employment, 2.5 million people work in Ireland. Growth in population, 1 million people. More footfall. National Development Plan, 165 billion. Record savings, 150 billion. And let the good times roll. And then I see consumer confidence in September of this year is at 42 on the index, which is a historic low of March 08, which was Lehman's crash, and March 2020, which was pandemic. Oh, my God. What's happening out there?
OK, where do we start with that? You know, clearly the 2 years of COVID, 2020, 2021, had a phenomenal impact. The second half of 2021, and I go back to 21 because to understand 22, you have to understand 21. Second half of 21, we saw the global economy being reopened. We saw the Irish economy being reopened. After a couple of years of restrictions, we saw this massive surge in repressed demand, came up against serious supply problems because a lot of supply was effectively shut down during COVID, or at least seriously restricted. So economics 101, when this massive surge in demand meets limited supply, inflation takes off. The view late last year into January and February of this year was that this would be transitory, that as we progress through 22, demand would level off again and supply would come back on stream and inflation would start to come back down. And most importantly, that was the view that central bankers very much have had, particularly the European Central Bank and most particularly Philip Lane, the chief economist. And central bankers basically back in January didn't believe they would have to do very much on the interest rate front. February 24th, Putin invades Ukraine and the world has fundamentally changed since then. And people will argue with me that really the inflation surge has nothing at all to do with Ukraine, that it was 10 years of quantitative easing and
I'm going to have to fall out with you over that, because like there's minority people like Eddie Hobbs who were saying 2 years ago that 10 years of quantitative easing and money printing and you know this thing about the dollar, was invented in 1914, and if you pile up all the dollars printed between 1914 and March 2020 and pile up all the dollars afterwards, the second pile is bigger. Sorry, every time in the history of money that we printed the lira, the Deutschmark, it resulted in hyperinflation. Why are you so adamant, given that it wasn't a temporary spike in inflation?
I'm not adamant. What I said was after 10 years of quantitative easing, you know, that there was a problem, but this problem was seriously exacerbated by COVID, number one, and number two, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And if you look at where the bulk of Irish inflation has come from over the last 12 months, it's energy, it's food, and both of those are heavily related to the Ukraine crisis and indeed COVID supply chain restrictions. So to argue that it's all because of quantitative easing is wrong. Quantitative easing created a very artificial situation. I mean, zero interest rates or negative interest rates, that ain't normal. And Milton Friedman, back in the 30s, the quantity theory of money, that inflation...
You'll be going back to Adam Smith next.
I will be next. But inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. In other words, if there's too much money supply, prices rise.
And for
a few years, that view was discredited. But it's back in
vogue. Yeah, no, but that theory is that actually the way you do it, you cannibalise money by losing the value of savings.
But I would ask the question, if quantitative easing hadn't happened during that 10 years, how much worse would the world have been? I think it would have been significantly worse. I think quantitative easing was not something central bankers were comfortable in doing. It was not a normal response, but it was necessary. Okay. Anyway,
we'll park there.
The bottom line, Ivan, is that inflation has become embedded in the system. In October, November of this year, we're looking at the highest recorded rates in 40 years or more in certain jurisdictions.
So what are you trending for 2023?
We saw in November, and I think we'll see it again in December, that the headline rate is starting to come down again, very modestly, and that's purely because of energy prices. You know, oil prices have fallen sharply, natural gas prices have fallen sharply, and that is now starting to feed into the measure.
So what are you predicting?
During 2023, Ivan, if even oil prices stay at current levels, the base effect on inflation will fall significantly. In other words, the year-on-year comparison. But what central bankers will be most concerned about is what's happening on the rest of inflation, the economy. So labour markets, and one of the strange phenomena we've seen in the last 12 months is, despite all the global headwinds, despite the significant slowdown in the global economy, rising interest rates and so on, labour markets remain very tight. We have a 3.7% unemployment rate in the States, 4.4% here, 6.5% in the Eurozone, which is the lowest ever. So labour markets are tight. So what central bankers will really worry about is that wage pressures start to intensify during 2023, and that inflation starts to feed into the service side of the economy, becomes embedded. And that is why central bankers, and this is going to determine 2023, central bankers have decided explicitly that they're going to take rates as high as necessary to prevent inflation from becoming embedded. And if that means economic recession and higher unemployment, so be it. Because central bankers are obviously paranoid about inflation becoming embedded. And there was an old theory from the 80s and after the two oil price crises that the persistence of inflation increases with the rate of inflation. In other words, we start to build high inflation into our behaviour. And that's what central bankers are adamant.
That's exactly what happened in the 80s.
It
is. So in other words, unlike the last crash where bang goes Lehman, bang goes the Irish banks, bang goes the Troika, you're not going to... Like what happened in the 80s when the oil price shock hit was we actually almost had a decade of stagflation. So is it reasonable to assume that we mightn't have a recession insofar as there'll still be some growth, but the growth rate will be less than the inflation rate, which means we'll all be worse off?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the Federal Reserve in its Monetary Policy Committee meeting, or the Federal Open Market Committee, as they call it, the FOMC, the week before last, when they increased rates by 0.5%, the accompanying statement was forecasting growth of 0.5% in 23 and under 1.5% in 2024. And by US standards, that is stagnation. And if economies fail to grow, and if populations are rising and so on, living standards decline. So I think over the next couple of years, you are going to see a decline in global living standards. I think it's going to be a much, much different economic environment. And of course, the big imponderable here is the impact of the Ukraine war on energy prices. You know, the risk is that this thing just rumbles on and perhaps escalating time to time, creating further energy shocks. So I think inflation next year is going to be about half what it was this year in measured terms.
But in historic terms, quite high.
In historic terms, very, very high, absolutely. So we're living with higher inflation for the foreseeable future. But I don't believe we're entering into a decade of stagnation. I don't believe we're entering into a decade of persistently
Let's move on to the public finances. I've often said that Pascal Donoghue was the luckiest general.
Yes.
Because, you know, I remember a few years ago, studying budgets as we do, corporation tax was about 5 billion. It's now heading for 20 billion. All this gusher of golden eggs laid by the tech firms has been fantastic. Will it last forever?
Well, the first 11 months of 2022, we took in over 21 billion in corporation tax. And that's 60% roughly ahead of the same period last year.
Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. And you say 5 billion. Actually, 10 years ago, we were talking about 4 billion in corporation tax. And one of the dramatic...
And it's paid all the bills.
One of the dramatic things that happened this year was that income tax is always the number one tax as a percentage of total taxation. VAT is always second. Corporation tax was a poor third. Corporation tax has now become second. And if you delve into it, 10 companies pay about 55% of that. 85% of the corporate tax take comes from the multinational sector. So there's a concentration risk. And the obvious risk here is that if one of those 10 companies, or a few of them, got into serious difficulty, we have a problem. And if you look at the global tech situation at the moment, I mean, I don't believe we're in a global tech meltdown as like what happened, the dot-com bubble back in 2002. But I think the tech sector has overextended and there's now a period of retrenchment because demand for tech services has fallen. There is probably $5 billion of that corporation tax take that is highly risky. And at any stage, it could disappear.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of risks.
Incredibly lucky.
Okay, there's a couple of risks. First of all, tell us about it. It's due to go from 12.5% to 15% across Europe. So therefore, people paying their corporation tax in Ireland and maybe selling goods and services abroad, I'm going to go through all the threats. That's one threat. Secondly, Amazon stock down 40%, Meta down more. Like there's something happening there. We see layoffs. Is that the second threat? In other words, they mightn't stay in Ireland, they mightn't make as much money, and could they hightail it out of here?
Well, there's about 120,000 people working in the IDA supported tech sector here, okay? And I think Patrick Collison in Stripe summed it up very, very well. If you ignore all the rubbish that's going on in Meta and Twitter and so on, Collison, I think, nailed it when he basically said he was announcing job layoffs in their global workforce. And he basically said, we over-anticipated the growth in the internet economy. We hired too many people. We are now resizing. And that's exactly what happened. The tech sector just got totally carried away.
And lockdown and probably meant more from home and all that.
It did, of course.
I'm round long enough
yeah.
that economists and politicians and business people, they don't often bell the cat. They believe in soft landings. They don't want their share price. They're not going to say the roof is going to fall in tomorrow. Like, should we be in any way sceptical of some of the reassurances?
Of course we should. One thing I've learned is that, unfortunately too late, but it always pays to be sceptical. I mean, the risks are very real out there. You know, Ireland has done incredibly well in the last 12 months, but a huge amount of that is on the back of FDI. The tech part is the risky part. The other part, the chemical and pharma sector accounts for 65% of our merchandise exports. It is booming at the moment. And the good thing about chemical and pharma is that it does require a heavy investment in bricks and mortar in the ground. So those pharma companies aren't going to take up their foundations and leave. So I think we're in a reasonably good position, but the risks are very, very real. And sorry, you want to
I know our biggest trading partner, 40% of its exports, it used to be anyway, Britain. How big a basket case is Britain post-Brexit? Because it's been depicted as a political problem, a Tory problem, Boris, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak and turmoil. But actually, if you dig deeper and you look at the fundamentals of their economy, even countries that they've done a trade deal with, like Japan, they're actually exporting less. They've obviously lost out within Europe. Some of the trade barriers and red tape are only starting to emerge. So there's strikes, there's public finance problems, there's less investment, less trade. How bad is it going to be? Say if I'm selling goods and services into Britain, say we're depending on British tourists coming here, where do you think sterling is going?
Britain is a basket case. There's no doubt about that. A month after the Brexit vote, I spoke at a Brexit lunch in Chelsea in London, and I stood up and said, basically, this is nuts. There is no
economic genocide on
Absolutely.
The British people.
And I said, the only question here is the magnitude of the damage. And the Centre for European Research yesterday published data showing that the UK economy is 5.5% smaller because of Brexit. And in fact, it's the only G7 country that is actually smaller now than prior to COVID. It's very sad, but everything, I think, the crisis, and it is a total crisis politically and economically at the moment, the health service is breaking down, and it all dates back to the 23rd of June 2016 and that Brexit vote. Everything in the UK since then has been seen through the prism of Brexit. It is poisonous. And
for those businesses and jobs depending on the UK,
yes.
What would you say to
them? Well, at an aggregate level, the UK now accounts for about 9% of our merchandise exports.
Is that
okay?
All?
For the agri-food sector, it's about 35%. So that's where the challenge is. But the agri-food sector actually is adapting. You know, they're finding other markets. And indeed, there was a story in social media during the week about an exporter of beverages out of the UK, who basically said that not alone have they lost their EU markets, but they've lost non-EU markets as well, because the customers now want to buy from EU countries. So Ireland actually is benefiting from that. And our agri-food exports in the first 10 months of this year are up about 25%. So, you know, it's not all doom and gloom for Ireland. There's a lot of stuff going well here, but the headwinds are obvious. You know, the cost of living crisis is going to continue. Housing is the biggest issue of national economic competitiveness, not to mind the social impact of the housing crisis. National economic competitiveness is being seriously damaged by the housing crisis, because the cost and the availability of housing, rents, etc. And interest rates are going to rise further. We're not at the end of that yet.
Okay. On the housing question, we're going to have the shiny new junior minister, Jennifer Carroll McNeill, Ivana Bacic and Louise O'Reilly of Sinn Féin joining us. And I will be putting them through the paces on housing supply. That's why I didn't labour that. I really found this discussion most insightful. Obviously, more troubled times ahead, but we won't die of the starvation just yet.
No, we won't, actually. I mean, maybe I'm an eternal optimist. I support Waterford hurling, for God's sake. But
right.
I do think that Ireland will be okay in 2023. Certain sectors I would really worry about: hospitality, non-essential retail, personal services. I think those sectors will have a very, very difficult, particularly the first 3 months of the year, because there is a sense at the moment there's a bit of a spending binge going on ahead of Christmas, as we always do, but that the bills, when they start arriving, particularly the energy bills resulting from the cold weather of last week, that is going to take a serious hit on consumer spending. And as you said in your introduction, you know, consumer confidence levels are now back where they were in March 20 and 2008. And that is now starting to reflect itself and will increasingly, I think, in the early months of next year. But professional services, FDI, will remain, I think, quite strong in the economy. And we come into this as well, running budget surplus, record levels of employment. So,
all right. And happy Christmas to you. Jim Power, thank you, economist. Thank you very much, Deed.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.